Well, hello and good evening. I think we'll go ahead and get rolling. Thank you all so much for being here tonight. Welcome to Policy in a Pint. I'm Steve Seal from 89.3 The Current, co-host of The Morning Show. Heard 6 to 10 a.m. weekdays, along with my partner Jill Riley. Policy in a Pint is a co-production of The Current and the Citizens League. We're very, very proud to have been partnered with them for some 8-plus years now, doing this great show, and we're very happy that the Varsity Theater has been a place that we've come back to again and again, year after year, to do these shows there. It's a wonderful venue for Policy in a Pint, so give it up for the Varsity Theater for setting such a nice atmosphere for us. Our sponsors, we have a new sponsor as of this show, actually. So thanks to the Minnesota Credit Union Network for joining us in supporting Policy in a Pint, and our seasonal sponsor this year, who has been Target already for the past several shows, and we appreciate both of their kind support. Tonight's program is the latest in our ongoing series that we're calling this year State of the State. We've been looking at issues that we need to address given the next generation of challenges Minnesota is going to face over the next 25 years. We began a few months ago looking at such things as the massive shifts in demographics coming to Minnesota, the state of race relations was just last month, how the arts help build vibrant urban cores. Naturally, talking about education was an obvious topic for us. We specifically wanted to address the problem facing minority populations in achievement levels and how much research shows minorities already behind before even starting school, and what can we do about that, because we all agree that's unacceptable. So, you know, this is obviously both an ethical slash moral issue, you know, that groups are so far behind apparently based on, you know, race and socioeconomic status. And it's an economic issue for Minnesota. We need everyone to be economically productive in the future given our demographic trends. And it's also an issue that we've been talking about for some 20-plus years with very little progress. And I'm sure we'll talk about, you know, why that is and how we want to finally be able to move the needle on this. What can we do to really make a difference in this now? Clearly, by stating such a topic as this, you know, it's obvious that we're taking up more than one subject that is very emotionally and politically charged. What's kind of interesting to me is that, you know, as we put together tonight's program, it became quite clear that even after last month's program that we did on the future of race relations in Minnesota, this is actually the most charged program that we've heard, you know, people's sort of feelings and emotions about going into, even more so than that one, ahead of time. We heard from a few people saying that our panel doesn't feature enough perspectives, the panel that we put together tonight. And so we wanted, you know, we want you to be the voice. This is how Policy in a Pint works. For those of you, if you're new to Policy in a Pint, what we do is that we put together as sort of interesting and diverse and balanced a panel as we can. We usually try to pick three guests, and that's about, you know, the maximum. It gets a bit unwieldy outside of that. Have really well-rounded panels. If they're obviously, you know, between the administrators and the one educator that we have here tonight, we don't have a currently public school teacher here with us tonight. Carrie was a public school teacher for 10 years up until very, very recently. We don't have a parent on stage with us tonight. We don't have a student on stage with us tonight. This is why we depend on, after we set the guests and our panels, we come to you. And we are looking forward to hearing the perspectives from our audience tonight and on Twitter, and putting those questions to this panel here tonight. Policy in a Pint has always been as open and vibrant a discussion as we can possibly make it be. And this is a program that's based on community dialogue, audience participation, I trust we'll have a lot of that here tonight, and I'm really looking forward to it. Although, I have to say that a lot of this is new to me, you know, as the sort of rock DJ guy. I may not be completely up on a lot of the terms here tonight. Be gentle with me, and I'll just, you know, your questions will be sent right here to our panel, and as the father of a two-year-old, I'm sure that I'll be very quickly be getting up to speed on a lot of these ideas. Let me introduce our guests. Michelle Walker is Chief Executive Officer of the St. Paul Public Schools. As Chief Executive Officer, Ms. Walker is the lead superintendent designee. Did I pronounce that word right?
Yes.
Is that how it's pronounced? And primary staff liaison to the Board of Education. She coordinates and supports the district's senior leadership team in its implementation of the Strong Schools, Strong Communities strategic plan. Ms. Walker supervises departments including human resources, finance, strategic planning and policy, racial equity transformation, and research, evaluation, and assessment. Prior to joining the St. Paul Public Schools executive team, she served as the chief of strategic planning and policy for the D.C. Public Schools, District of Columbia Public Schools. Sandra Samuels is the president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone, which focuses on ending multi-generational, easy for me to say, poverty through education, working in a collaboration of more than 35 partner nonprofits and schools. The Northside Achievement Zone is working toward a single goal to prepare 2,500 low-income North Minneapolis children to graduate from high school ready for college. Do you say the NAZ or NAS?
NAS.
You say NAS.
Yeah.
So the NAS works to support parents as they aim to create a college-bound culture in their homes and in their community. Under Mrs. Samuels' leadership, NAS was named a federal promise neighborhood and has become a nationally recognized model for community development and change. Carrie Muse has been a teacher for many years. As I said, he was actual district school teacher up until very recently. Began in Texas, was in Oakland, California for a period of time, 7 years, is that right? 7 years in California. Teaching in Oakland for some significant part of that time. And Carrie helped propel the Kip Bridge Charter School in Oakland to become one of California's highest performing high poverty urban middle schools. Carrie has worked in both district and charter schools for the last 11 years and is currently Chief Learning Officer and Head of School at Venture Academy, a new public charter school in Minneapolis. So, we'll get started here in a moment. I just wanted to say the format as it stands is I'm going to ask questions for a little while of our guests here and then launch into the audience and get your questions. Please be thinking of them. And the only rule really that I have is I hold the mic and you can't grab it from me, even though you may try. So that's pretty much the rule. And speechifying, not a big fan. But a question is awesome. So please form your speech in the form of a question, please. No. We may have some points that want to be made here tonight, and I don't want to discourage them, but I do hold the mic. Thank you. So a warm welcome for all of our guests here tonight to Policy and a Pint. I wonder if you guys could, like, sum up, even though I've read your actual, like, official bios here, could you actually say, like, if there's a better way to put what you do in your job in any given week, if you had to describe it to me in an elevator in 30 seconds, do you have that as a mental note in your head, Michelle? Could you do that?
Oh, great.
Yeah, of course, I'm going to start with Michelle. Yeah.
What I do. Okay, so I guess what I think I do is to support the school district to do its primary mission to educate kids. So I'm in the central office. I'm not in a classroom, but I need to make sure that everything that we do in the central office supports what's happening in the classroom, and that's from the mundane to the real specific. And so I view myself as support for the real work.
Sandra, with the NAS,
She's a big chief. She's not saying that. She's being modest. But you know what? I am a revolutionary, right? Revolutionary. And a loving one, okay? Not bellicose, a loving one. And I say that because, you know, I feel like in the work that I'm doing and building this movement in North Minneapolis with a bunch of partners, so in partnership, I'm not doing anything by myself, of really changing the ethos around what education reform is all about and saving our children. You know, this is, you know, I just want to, like, keep fire up underneath our ASSs that our kids are dying. You know,
we're not, like, on the radio, by the way, so
But so, you know, that our babies are dying. I mean, both, like, I'm in the middle of North Minneapolis. I'm at ground zero. You know, our babies are dying both figuratively and literally. You know, we keep talking about this cradle to prison pipeline, cradle to grave pipeline. We don't often talk about a lot, but, you know, like, the second leading cause of death for young African-American males in Minnesota is homicide, particularly in my community. And it always rolls back to what's happening at home, what's happening in education, and what's happening in our community. And they're all very much interlinked, interconnected. And I just feel like we as a state haven't really gotten serious about it. We're too Minnesota nice. But when we really realize and we see the children and we see our children or our nieces and our nephews and neighbors, that maybe we'll really feel the sense of urgency. So I didn't really answer your question, but I'll get to that later.
If I'd been on an elevator with you right there, though, I'd be on your team immediately
I
think.
Cool.
Hell yeah. Also, ass. Let's just say it. Ass. Yeah, again, not on the radio here. Carrie.
Tough act to follow. But I would say absolutely, just like Sandra, on the ground level every single day, helping 115 sixth and seventh graders and the people who are doing their heart's work to teach them, try to help them reach their full potential. And really, honestly, just teach them to be indignant about the state of what they're up against.
Right.
Because they're up against a lot. And so for me, my job every day is to be an ally to them so that they can have opportunities.
Let's get to some definitions, because we're going to talk about a couple of things that are going to come up over and over tonight. So let's talk about the achievement gap. Last month, we had Nikema Levy-Pounds here with us, who is a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, for those of you not familiar, director of the Community Justice Project, professional force of nature. And she pointed out how she prefers the term opportunity gap to achievement gap, because it takes into account the sort of built-in obstacles that communities of color face before even entering the classroom. It's kind of an astute viewpoint on the matter, I thought. Your feelings on this, on the idea of opportunity gap?
Well, I would support the term opportunity gap, but when we talk about achievement, I just call it what it is. It's racial disparities in achievement. So if we talk about any gap and we don't put race in the middle of it, then we're not having a real conversation, mm-hmm. because the disparities are racially predictable. Mm-hmm. And I think once we frame it in that way, we're able to actually address the real problem that we face.
Yeah, that's the deal. Like, you got to get really real about what is happening and call the elephant out in the middle of the room. And it is about race. It is about economics. And there is so much going on in society. We have so many gaps in Minnesota. I mean, we are chief in gaps, right? So we have the highest unemployment gap in the country, racial unemployment gap in the country, and between, again, black and white, income gap. You know, achievement gaps. So there's all opportunity gaps, what's available to you. I mean, there's so many gaps, and we are so chief. I mean, like Minnesota is like, we're featuring big with the gaps. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that we get, like, just absolutely tired of it, because this is a great state, and we have everything that we need to get rid of those.
Carrie, did you want to jump in?
I mean, as long as we're ranked dead last in Latino, Native graduate, and second, an African-American grad rate, you actually can't call it anything other than an achievement gap.
Yeah.
So we begin with this assumption that minority children begin schooling at a disadvantage. and perform more poorly than non-minority children throughout the lifespan of their schooling. This is our non-challenged assumption here, basically. So who gets to define what the achievement gap actually is? Like, what is it? Somebody said to you, sum it up for me. I've read, actually, commentary of people saying, I don't know exactly what it is. I mean, like, educators saying, nobody really agrees on what we mean when we say achievement gap, so.
Well, I'm not sure what the disagreement is, but if you look in terms of the ways that you measure achievement, it's not limited to standardized tests. When we look in St. Paul, we look at test scores, attendance, we look at disparities in discipline, we look at disparities in actually who gets identified for gifted and talented versus who gets identified for special education. You look at all of those factors. So you can't just narrow it down to a test score. You look at preparation for kindergarten. You look at preparation for post-secondary. It's all of those factors. And all of those combined raise a lot of issues around opportunity and disparity. But I also want to go back to what you said about early childhood, for example. We know early intervention is an answer. And we've seen a lot of success, particularly in St. Paul, with our early learning opportunities. And we see those disparities actually narrow, and in many instances are eliminated. But the sad part is what you start to see once kids become school age. Right. So we see kids enter kindergarten ready for learning, outpacing some of their peers who haven't had early childhood experiences. But by the time they get to third grade, we're back talking about the disparities that we've had. Mm-hmm. So it's not just early learning. It's also what do we do throughout the entire K-12 experience and the post-secondary experience to make sure that we are preparing kids for what they're going to enter.
So when we get to the answer a lot of the time and how is this achievement gap measured, a lot of the answer that's given is, well, testing. And testing is what people love to hate,
right?
You know, right? Because it's potentially just intrinsically biased. It's potentially measuring the wrong things, but you're saying that generally when the achievement gap is talked about, we actually, in fact, are talking about it's being measured in a lot of different ways?
Well, I think generally people are talking about test scores, but you could take any of the factors that are related to student performance and see those gaps.
Right.
So who has higher attendance or absence rates? Who has higher disproportionality around who gets identified for special ed? So it's not just testing. You can dispute testing all year long. Let's take test out of the equation and still look at the gaps that you see between racial groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. And then I'll go ahead.
I said, from a perspective of someone who's been a classroom teacher for a really, really long time, all you have to do is look at kids. We're working with 6th and 7th graders who are reading on average at a 3rd or 4th grade level. That's just a fact. It has nothing to do with a standardized test. It just has to do with they're not where they need to be.
It's just apparent on its face, yeah.
And like Michelle was saying, so the gap is made up of a lot of things depending on who you talk to. So I'm part of something called the African American Leadership Forum, and a couple years ago, and I think you've had like Chris Stewart on the panel,
and
the professor. She's also there's a bunch of us, but so we talk about that the gap is made up of a number of gaps, the achievement gap. So one is, and we wrote a black paper, and. And the first gap is the preparation gap. You know, again, kids are not starting school ready for kindergarten, and they usually never catch up. So the preparation gap. And then we have the teaching gap. You know, we don't have the highest quality teachers in front of our children, particularly resource poor brown and black kids who are in the inner city. Then we have a leadership gap, you know, around, you know, to get a great teacher, you also have to have great leaders. So there's a leadership gap. And then there is a belief gap. You know, do we really believe that children from a certain zip code, a zip code that's mired in so many different challenges like mine, 55411, that a child can actually succeed? And the zip code is just proxy for poverty and race, right? And then we also have a time gap. So if, like you were saying, the kids are like 3 grade levels behind, we're finding that in North Minneapolis too, 2-3 grade levels behind, then you would say, if you were really results driven, well, if they're behind, we have to be about making sure they get caught up. And so we have a time gap. We need more time on task with great teachers, great curriculum, and belief that every single child, regardless of their zip code, can achieve.
And I have 3 hours worth of questions here that I'm not going to get to because I want to let you guys answer the questions. But it's almost like, how do we logically structure this conversation? The last sort of umbrella topic I want to get to before going out is, you know, sum up, if there's a way to sum up solutions from the three of you, what are the sort of the outline of solutions that you are using in your respective spheres to attack these issues? So in St. Paul Public Schools.
So I started with how we frame the conversation around the gap by isolating race. And so St. Paul has a very long track record of being the best in a lot of things. And what I've discovered about Minnesota, because I'm not originally from here, is that we're very proud about being good about many things and not necessarily as willing to look at where we have our challenges. So the first part is isolate race and really have a conversation about race. And nobody wants to have a conversation about race. It's not something that we all sign me up, please. But it's the difficult conversation that we need to have, and it really starts with self-examination. Because as Sandra said, that belief part is fundamental to any success that we're going to have. If you don't have high expectations for students, right, it's not enough to say, I treat all kids the same.
Right.
All kids are not the same.
Right.
And equity is a very different conversation to equality. Mm-hmm. And what I think we've thought in the past is, let's give everybody the same, let's treat everyone the same, and we'll get the same results.
What do you mean by that? Equity is different from equality.
Okay, so the analogy that I like to use that I heard from someone is, equality is giving everyone a pair of shoes. And equity is giving everyone a pair of shoes that fits them. So clearly my shoes look a lot different than yours, and we each need a pair of shoes that fit us. So if you listen to what Sandra and Kerry said about students who come to us who are 2 years behind, 3 years behind, clearly you can't approach that student in the same way that you're going to approach a student who's at grade level or even accelerated. Each of them requires something different, but both of them require the same level of expectation and belief that they can achieve. It may require more time, it may require different curriculum, it may require different strategies, but you have to be willing to meet students where they are and give them what they need, each individual student, and that's a difficult thing to do.
So I'm going to let you guys answer in just a second, but I want to follow up with you quickly.
Yes.
Because I really want to know, because you talk about the problems of
right.
And the reason I want to follow up with you before getting to the two of them is because my sense is that being in the district school system, it's simply harder for you to do what you have to do than, for example, what Kerry gets to do in his charter school. So where has there been success with you actually broaching the topic of race? You know what I'm saying?
Sure. So we've approached it systemically. We actually started with district leadership, and we have been engaged in racial equity professional transformation, is what we call it, racial equity transformation, for about 2.5 years. And we started intentionally with district leadership, school board, superintendent's cabinet, and then went to the school level, because we actually have had schools that have been doing great work. We have had schools that have taken this on their own without others telling them that it was necessary. But if you don't have the support at the top to actually really buffer and give the resources that are necessary to do this work, it fizzles out. So we've always had high-quality teachers. We've always had excellent classrooms, excellent school communities. What we haven't had is an entire system of
right.
excellence. And that's
right.
where the challenge is as
right.
a district.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have 39,000 students, 69 mm-hmm. schools and programs. How do you turn an entire system around to have the kind of success that yeah. your individual school has, or that maybe a handful of our schools have? How do you create that systemically? And that's what's different in the work that perhaps a charter school and a traditional school district may have. It's not to say that it can't happen, but I've worked in bureaucracies for quite some time, and they are designed to get the results that they get. Mm-hmm. Bureaucracies are designed to exist, and that's the hardest thing to do, change a bureaucracy, move transformation systemically to bring it to scale. And so that's why we focused on racial equity, because at the foundation of that, it's changing personal belief. Because systemic technical pieces, that's not going to get the kind of change that you need to see across a district.
Carrie, tell me about success on the ground. What does it look like? How does it happen?
I mean, it's high expectations for every kid. So not to sound like an echo, but it's every single person that is part of a team working together on the same page, going in the same direction.
Right.
And it is easier for me than it is for a district. Like, it totally is. Because it's a smaller, there's less variable. There's a little bit more freedom to get that ship going in that direction. But every person, regardless if you're in a district, a private school, a charter school, we're all here because you all should be here because you believe in the capacity of a child to reach their full potential. And, like, honestly, if that's not why you're in education, then you should reevaluate why you are in education, to just say that as politely as I can. But we have to work together, and we have to learn from each other. You know, our school venture, like, we're still figuring it out. You know, we're still learning. You know, we all need to be learning together to best meet the needs of kids, but those expectations have to be super high. And then the other thing is, you know, making room for innovation, you know. So, like, things like Venture Academy, also, you know, Upper Mississippi Academy Charter School, which was supported and endorsed by the Minnesota Federation of Teachers. The union teachers actually started that school. That's, like, should be applauded. Like, yeah. Bold movements like that should be applauded because we're putting what kids need first, and that's the piece that has to be in place for us to really close this gap.
Yeah, and so, like, really quick.
Quick. Seriously, because I'm like, NAS is all about the most holistic, yeah, you know, involvement there could possibly be, and so yeah. I want to hear about that now.
Yeah, so the deal for us is that we really believe that the success of any scholar, we call all our babies, all our students scholars. Even when they're in the womb, they're a scholar, because we're trying to get at that belief gap. But anyway, that their success rests on a four-legged stool. And the thing that we're doing right now throughout the country is we're doing the blame game. So if you try to talk about what schools need to do, you're bashing teachers. And if you try to talk about what families need to do, you're blaming the victims. And if you try to talk about policymakers not stepping up and changing the structure of education, then you're blaming them. And if you try to talk about communities, well, we're beleaguered. You know, how can you do that to us? And the thing is that, you know, you're as sick as your secrets, and we all have to own our blame in that. I'm to blame too, right? I'm an adult. We don't have a child problem. We have an adult problem because we have not stepped up to change things. So four-legged table is around families, right? So four-legged table starts with families, because we're saying that babies don't show up at school ready. Our families need, especially resource-poor brown and black families, and, you know, what we're finding are some families who the mom never graduated high school herself and had a real icky experience when she was in school, right? And then she becomes a mother, and we say, go join your PTA and be in school. And, you know, and she never did that herself. Right. It was, like, creepy for her. And so, but anyway, but what we're finding is that our families just need some support. They need a partnership. They don't need a savior. They don't need to get fixed. But they do need to find out how critical those early years are, what you need to do. So we have something called College Bound Babies Program. It's for parents who have children 0 to 3, and they learn all about brain development, positive discipline. And when the parents graduate, the babies graduate too. And we give them these little T-shirts that say college graduate. And the year that they'll graduate from a four-year college, not a two-year college, even though we love two-year colleges too, but a four-year college because we're shooting for the stars. And if they land at a two-year, great. But anyway, but coming beside parents. And then schools. The number one thing a school can do besides complain about poverty is to have great teachers in front of every student. That is the number one thing schools can do. And right now, we have laws in Minnesota, this gets into policymakers, that we have stuff like last in, first out, where in times of layoff, the only thing that you can consider is how long a teacher has been teaching.
not how effective they have been in the classroom. We are only one of 11 states that still has that antiquated policy, and I can give you a gazillion more. So anyway, so those kind of things need to change. And we do have great teachers, so don't get me wrong. But just like every business person isn't the same, every other industry, we say people are not the same, right? You have some excellent computer companies. You have some that aren't excellent. But as soon as you say not all teachers are the same, you're bashing teachers. But anyway, we have to commit to great teachers. Then community, we need to step up. And so from the African-American community perspective, we got to stop blaming the man, and we have to, like, figure out what we need to do. Like Martin Luther King said, if you're not bent over, nobody can walk on your back. And so what we're doing in North Minneapolis is this real wraparound support for all of our families through the Northside Achievement Zone, 37 organizations doing that. But again, policymakers have to step up and do what's right about children, not people who vote. Just vote. Because kids don't vote. That's why we have the problems we have.
And I can't tell you how perfectly you have set the stage for
the
second part of tonight's presentation, which is our audience questions. So let's hear them. Let's see some hands now for who wants to ask some questions. You're kidding me. All right, right on. I'm going to go to the first hand that I saw, actually, right out here. And, you know, we can actually go into as long as we need to into, like, an absolute end of 7:30. We used to make these things an hour. It's like 13 minutes to 7 now. So we could go all the way to 7:30 if you guys have the questions for it. But it's up to you. All right, first question.
Hi. I'm just curious about if you have any idea of what your tipping point is. What do you think, when we reach this point, it's all going to be downhill from here? It's going to be a battle that's going to get progressively easier. Because right now it sounds like a battle that's getting progressively harder. What do you, when you visualize a tipping point, what do you see?
Yeah, we actually, that's our premise of change in North Minneapolis with the Northside Achievement Zone. So our whole thing is to change everything about a child's life at once. So we have housing organizations working together to end the high mobility. We have career financial pathways organizations because if a child's not eating because their parents aren't working, they can't really focus when they go to school. We have behavioral health organizations, early childhood, plus the schools are working together, public district, public charter, parochial, and then out of school time in colleges and mentoring organizations. Anyway, the whole thought, and this is from the Harlem Children's Zone. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Harlem Children's Zone. So that's a place-based strategy as well, where you do all of this wraparound in one community, right? And they're doing it in Central Harlem, and they just deliver, like, saturate the community with supports. And anyway, what they found in Central Harlem, and today they've had incredible success. As my kids would say, they've had stupid success, where they have 900 historically uneducable kids that you would label uneducable. Today they're in college. And so what they found in Harlem was that when they actually wrapped around 60% of the families, they saw this tipping point that shifted the culture to a college-going culture. And in North Minneapolis, what we're trying to do within our geographic zone is we're at about a 50%, we will be at about a 50% penetration. We hear that once you hit about 40 to 60% of a population and they transform, that they then drive the culture. So for us, we're shooting for 50%, but I've heard the norm in terms of a tipping point being 40 to 60%.
I'm gonna let you go. Okay. I'm still thinking.
I can tell you this. The tipping point isn't going to come from education alone. There's a lot that we can do in schools, and there's a lot that we can do in classrooms, but I think until we do have more things happening, like what's happening with NAS or with Harlem Children's Zone, where we're supporting everything from birth up. This is beyond education. This is so much more, and it's so complex. But I can tell you, from my opinion, in my experience, the tipping point isn't just going to come from education. It's
right.
Lots of things working together.
Right. And I guess I would absolutely agree with that. And if I think about it in the context of a school district, because to go back to what I was telling Steve, it is an institution. It's a bureaucracy. And you will find across the country that most school districts have not made rapid transformation in terms of an entire school district. And so when I think about what the tipping point might be for some of the things that we want to see sustainably, the first thing is consistent leadership in a school district. And fortunately for us at St. Paul, our superintendent has been in this particular district for 27 years. So this is a person who actually understands it, the system, and they understand work and still can push for change. But when I hear the average school teacher, the average school custodian, the average school counselor speaking some of the same language that you would hear administrators speak, then I know that the culture is actually shifting, and it's not just because someone from central office says it needs to be so or a particular school says it needs to be so, that the language becomes so much a part of what we're doing that it's actually coming from various parts of the organization, even if people aren't necessarily connecting the dots that this is this particular initiative or that particular initiative. And that's where I think things fall apart for school districts, because we try a lot of things, but we never sustain that change for long enough for it to actually be a part of the culture. And so I would measure it. I think it's about the same 40 to 60%. But when you think about a school district with 6,000 employees, that's a lot of people to make that kind of transformation. And quite frankly, we usually don't have leadership stick around long enough for it to work.
I have got a couple of questions I want to get to. But Carrie, I want to follow with you really quick. We agree that we have this systemic change that needs to take place. But give me an example of something that is effective in the classroom.
So putting kids in charge of their own learning. Mm-hmm. So at Venture, what we're really trying to do, and we're learning every day, so I'm just going to put that out there, like we're still learning. But our premise, and this is actually how I was successful in my classroom in Oakland, is sometimes you just have to get out of the kids' way. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes you have to. And we make a lot of assumptions as adults about what kids need. And I think this comes back to your point about kids don't vote, so we make a lot of opinions for them without actually engaging them in a broad level about what they think they need. And kids know. Every single kid wants to learn, and kids know what they don't know. They may need some refinement. They may need an adult to help pull it out of them, but they know. And so conversations with, like, what we're doing is we're having conversations with kids. When a kid, I'll use an assessment as an example, even though we all hate assessment, it's necessary sometimes to know where a kid is. When we take an assessment, we engage kids in the process of how they did, but not just in like in a real way. Like, what do you know? What do you need to know to get better? Like, set goals around this. And it's a consistent conversation. So it's not just adults having that conversation and giving that information to kids, but it's actually having a conversation with them as stakeholders in their learning. And I say this, and in my mind, I mean, it's a relatively simple idea. It's not rocket science. But until we start actually cultivating kids to be creators and co-leaders of their learning, all they're going to be is consumers. And that's not going to help us make any growth towards closing this gap.
All right, next question.
Hey, thank you for being here.
Yeah, applause. Slow applause for that's the slow clap. One slow clap, and now the room joins in. Sorry,
I'm a proud teacher in St. Paul Public Schools since 1984, and I've seen a lot change, and it's been beautiful lately. There are a couple of things that make me think about white elephants in the room that never get spoken, and some of it have been spoken a little bit tonight. One of them is what kind of irks me is under the skin a media piece, our local media. Its color and its tone around money and what we spend our money on, where we really put our money. And for me, it's entertainment. We are so much into entertainment in our society. And then we talk about education funding. And I'm, again, St. Paul guy and thinking about our drama of the last few weeks. Yeah. But it's really about putting that white elephant out there and saying, what does it really cost to educate a child? And let's look at the cost and compare it to entertainment. Mm-hmm. Because I think we have to say, well, we're not really telling the truth about. What is that truth for you about what you're hearing me say?
Well, first, thank you very much for your dedication to our children. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we could have conversation all day long about the investments that we choose to make in education, we collectively, society collectively, versus the investments that we make in other things. And as much as our media has actually gotten better around our school district, I think they fuel a lot of the conversations, number one, in terms of pitting people against each other, and not necessarily creating the culture that Sandra talks about in terms of the partnership and the collaboration that's necessary to get this work done. And yes, we need to have honest conversations about what districts aren't doing, what families are or aren't doing, what teachers may or may not be doing. We need to have all of those conversations, but they need to be done in a constructive way, and they need to be done in a way that really gets to the bottom of no one of us have all of those solutions. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, for however many hours of a day, we have teachers who are in front of our children who have dedicated their lives to this profession, and they need all of the support that they can for their own profession as well as for supporting their child. And first of all, we need to acknowledge that parents are our first teachers. Yeah. So if parents aren't at the table in the discussion, and I don't mean physically showing up for right. the PTAs yeah. and all of that, but in true partnership mm-hmm. with our educators, we're not going to get anywhere. So I fully support what I think I hear you saying is media can sometimes be a source of some of those divisions, but I think what you know has transpired over the last few weeks in St. Paul really shows that at the end of the day, if we're not standing side by side, whoever we are in this work of education, we're not going to get what we need to get done for our children. We do need to get out of the way as adults and think about what our shared values are in our shared pursuit to give the best experience to our children. So,
all right, our next question.
This is for Dr. Walker. I'm not 100% certain if I heard correctly, and if I did not, then there's no question here. What I think I heard as you were talking about preschool was that sometimes underprivileged children get help and they come to school really rather ready to learn. But by third grade, suddenly there's a difference or a gap again. And if that was something that you said, would you please talk about what happens? Why doesn't it hold?
Sure. First, I want to thank you for giving me my doctorate, although I'm not yet finished with my dissertation. So thank you. And secondly, yes, I did say that. And to better frame that conversation, what we see in our district, and actually I think this is a similar trend across the country, We make the investments in early education, and we actually see a level playing field for the most part when students enter kindergarten, those who've had high quality early childhood experiences, and they enter kindergarten ready. We see some sustained success through kindergarten, and they probably enter first grade ready, but then we start to see those gaps. And part of it is what we even noticed in our school district. We've had a very strong pre-K program for quite some time, but there was actually a little bit of a misalignment between our pre-K programming and our K-12 programming in terms of really shoring up our students with some of the same practices, some of the same strategies to ensure that sustained success. So I think part of it is some of the investments that we make, the strategies that we have in early childhood, we probably don't replicate some of those when we get to the K-3 experience. And so with each year, students are falling further and further behind if you're not sustaining some of those strategies. And we've done a good job so far in getting our pre-K teachers and our K teachers to have more conversations with what's happening, to do some partnerships across early childhood and kindergarten, to even have stronger partnerships across K-3. So we had kindergarten, first grade, second and third grade teachers who may not necessarily have had opportunities to share their practice and skill so that each of them are doing what is necessary to kind of prepare students for the next stage. We're learning a lot about what that expanding our thought about the early childhood experience, not just being those 0 to 3 years or even 3 to 5 years, but actually all the way to third grade is really an early childhood opportunity and mirror some of those strategies. So I don't know, you probably have seen some of that too in your experiences, but that's kind of how we've noticed it, and we're still doing a lot more research in terms of how much time is lost, how much gaps occur over that period of time.
Yeah, it's actually called the fade-out effect, where they're ready, they start ready, and then they enter into our system and lose some of the gains. One of the, and part of it, and I always try to talk, we usually have two camps. We have early childhood advocates who are like, yes, just get them ready for K. And then, okay, we're done. And then you have the K through 12 who are like, you know, can't spend money back there. The real fight is up here. Are you forgetting about the high schoolers? And really, a child needs support all the way through. Yep. They need great teachers all the way through. They need involved parents all the way through. They need a system that believes that they can actually achieve and learn all the way through. And so I'm really heartened, though. I mean, the importance of early childhood just cannot be diminished, because even the students, from some of the research that I've seen, even the students that lose some academic gains, they still, some of the research, the Perry preschool research and so on, still after high school, their life outcomes are better than the scholars who were not ready for kindergarten and still went through a system that failed them. And because the bottom line, we just got to be real, the system has been failing our kids in so many myriad of ways.
All right, next question.
Thanks. So I'm just thinking about, we're talking about racial disparities, we're talking about the elephant in the room, and looking around this room and thinking about Minnesota and thinking about the importance of, you know, middle-class white families as well. I'm wondering, what role do you think that they have in helping to close these gaps?
So I guess the first thing to is to acknowledge that middle-class white families have a role in closing the gap, because any child that has a high, when you have high quality educational experiences for children in classes, it's not just for the black and brown kids. Right. All children need to understand and have exposure to high expectations. And if there's a classroom environment where you're holding different kids to different standards, no matter what they look like, that's not good for any of the children. And folks need to also be able to frame the conversation in, if my black son does well, it doesn't mean that your white son isn't going to do well. And in fact, I think because we framed race relations as a win-lose situation in this country for so long, it makes people feel like they don't have a part and a stake in this conversation. Right. So the fact of the matter is, if you care nothing about race, in 20 years, there are going to be some people on this stage and in other stages that look a lot more like me than the folks in the audience who are in charge of the cities, the counties, our legislature. And so you have a stake in the game if you pay taxes right here in this state to make sure that you are also being a part of the solution and not the problem. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, we see a lot of folks who come to our school board meetings, and that is not necessarily the vehicle to see a lot of people of color. But when we have conversations about changes that are happening in our school system, we can have people who are saying that they're committed to public education and they're committed to seeing things change, but not in my backyard, not in my school. I don't want anything to change in my school, but I'm all about equality. I'm all about helping to solve poverty. But the minute that there becomes a problem in their, what is perceived to be a problem in their school, those are the folks who flood the school board meeting and have complaints about it, but it's all framed in a nice, wonderful Minnesota nice package about what, you know, what is, you know, wrong with this particular situation. And we either don't see those same parents coming out to support a decision that might be one around an equity issue. We also don't see that level of support when we're doing some real systemic changes that would actually improve all children's experiences. And so I guess the bottom line, to sum it all, is the acknowledgement that white middle-class families do have a stake in this game, and that anytime we lift the education of children of color, we're lifting the education of all students. And we have the highest, among the highest performing white students in the country. So if we really want to say we're in a solid, strong state with education, then why shouldn't we also have the highest performing students of color in the country? And why should there be the disparities? Clearly, we know what to do.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I've never been prouder of my white middle class brothers and sisters, and I mean that sincerely, than this last mayoral campaign. The education would not have been a campaign issue if it were not for this coming together of black, white, middle class, low income to say you will mayoral candidate make it an issue. Because, you know, prior to that, you know, the mayor's not over the school board. This is Minneapolis. The mayor's not over the school board. And so most mayoral candidates just, like, don't touch. They're like, that's not my purview. I'm not, you know, it has an independent. But the voters, again, a lot of middle-class white folks in partnership said, no, it is an issue. Don't care if you're not over it. You're over the city. And we care about the future of our city. So I was really proud. And I just have to really give a shout out about that. Y'all aren't all racist. we got some good ones among us.
That is so awesome. Yeah. All right, our next question.
All right, so thanks for being here, guys. As you guys are talking, one of the things that I'm thinking about, and I appreciate the gentleman in the front that spoke, for the time you've invested in our kids, one of the elephants that I think about is we talk a lot about excellent teachers. And I recently read an article that talked about how about 40 to 50% of all new teachers leave the profession between the first 5 years. And it's actually 80% of teachers of color that start between the first year and fifth year. They just completely drop out of the profession. I'm wondering what we can do to get these teachers to stick around so they can become excellent, because I don't really think you start off on the first, second, third, or even on the 20th year and don't have anything to improve on. What can we do?
Fantastic question.
It comes down to support and development. So we have to invest in educating and developing our teachers just like we do our kids, and making that a priority in schools. As far as why people leave the profession, I think people leave for a variety of reasons. I think we look at education, and, you know, I'll call it an elephant in the room, and this one's constantly called upon, is how much teachers are paid. It's an incredibly underpaid profession for the amount of work that goes into it, and I do not want to open up a conversation that comes into to performance based anything, but I do think that if you were a doctor, you have someone's life in your hand, and you can you have someone's life in your hand as a teacher. We have to start looking at teacher development in a different way, similar to how they do doctor's residencies. You know, we have to really not throw our young to the wolves, so to speak, when they're first, second-year teachers, but incubate and help develop it and grow them so they can be their best and feel supported to stay and continue growing.
I'm sorry, I can't see you anymore.
I'm sorry, I'm just saying, please don't listen to me, you talk.
I think there are a number of factors that come into play in terms of why teachers may stay or leave the profession. So I totally agree with Carrie in terms of the supports for that work. And when I think about my own experience at a premier school of education right in the middle of New York City in Harlem, although they don't like to say that they're in Harlem, which is another issue. And the conversations that we were having about the urban education experience compared to what most teachers were going to leave that environment and experience were totally discongruent. I mean, most teacher education programs are not preparing teachers for what they're actually going to face in the classroom. So I think that there is some onus and responsibility that schools of education need to take in terms of the preparation, not in terms of the technical skills or around pedagogy, but really giving teachers exposure to the environments that they are going to be in and preparation to function well in those environments.
Secondly, school districts spend a lot of money on professional development, precisely because schools of education don't prepare teachers for the environments that they're going to encounter. But most of the time, that professional development is not organized or structured in a way that is really supportive of teachers, that actually helps them with the kinds of things that they want help with. And we've tried to change that paradigm to really respond to what the needs of the teachers are and not have a one-size-fits-all. So a first-year teacher is not going to need the same professional development as a 20-year teacher. And you're absolutely right. We all have something to learn in our profession, no matter how long we've been in it. And actually, the kind of sit-and-get approach where someone comes in who's an expert in the field to tell you X, Y, and Z is also not the best professional development for adults. We like to learn from each other, doing things, seeing, and all of that. And so as school districts, we need to restructure the kind of professional development that we're providing for teachers. But Sandra made a very interesting point. And when you talk about teachers of color and they're exiting the profession, what we see in our district and in most districts are the teachers of color are the newer teachers to come into the district for the most part, the last ones in the district. We have a probationary period, and when districts get to the point where they have to make cuts, et cetera, obviously the last teachers that come in are the ones to leave, and those are mostly teachers of color. And so until we change those structures, you're really not going to have the kind of changes that you want to see. And that doesn't mean that children of color need teachers of color, but I will tell you, going to school in New York City, the first black teacher that I had in an all-black neighborhood was in fifth grade. And that woman, I had an impression on me that I remember till this day. I remember Helen Dowdy till this day. And I always wanted to be a teacher, but when I saw a woman that looked exactly like me, it made me believe that I actually could do this. And so there is an importance of having teachers of color in our profession, and we need to do everything that we can to incentivize people of color to enter the profession and support them when they get into the profession.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want, I agree with everything Michelle said. And again, so there is some laws that need to get changed, bottom line, right? And so we need to have the guts to make that happen. But I do think that teachers absolutely have to get paid more. I mean, like, they should be the highest paid. You know, teachers are, and that's another thing that we could change as a society. Our elected officials work for us, you know, and budgets are based on values. And if we don't demand it, it's never going to happen. You know, teachers really are our nation builders. There's no other occupation that's building this country. And until our values line up with that, we're going to continue to see the burnout that we have.
So this is at the point of the program where I remember that about, an hour ago, I forgot to say, hashtag policy pines is the place to go, and I hope that most of you have figured that out. The question came in on Twitter, actually, that says, you know, to get these great teachers and the programs needed to help close the gaps, where does the funding come from?
Well, I don't think you need funding to get great teachers. I mean, I think great teachers need to get paid well, but there are great teachers all around this country, and they're making nothing. You know, they're just, like, committed to the work. So for me, it's not a funding issue to have great teachers in the classroom, to have any greatness. That needs to follow it, don't get me wrong, but that it doesn't break our ability to have excellence in our educational system.
Next question. Agreed. Sorry, I hold the mic.
Sorry. I agree. There's plenty of blame to go around because things have gotten just that bad. And so let's assume that we as adults put on our big boy pants and our big girl pants and we're ready to make the shift that needs to happen. I wonder where the accountability in this very bureaucratic, systemic system, how does it look like? What would it be? And maybe even go beyond the testing measurements you know, to complement that, I feel like we need a robust accountability system.
I'll start with that. When I was in the process of getting started with Venture Academy, someone said that the future of education is special education. And specifically, let me clarify that. So my background is actually as a special education teacher. That's how I started. And it comes back to this point that fair doesn't mean everyone gets the same. Fair means people get what they need. And I think when we start looking at every kid on like a personalized learning plan or pathway that is specifically tailored to them and their needs, that's where the accountability comes in. How are kids progressing at their optimal level to have as many opportunities as they possibly can? And that's my opinion on that.
I would agree with Carrie that we need to shift our conversation around accountability. And I think Steve talked about the fact that I supervise the research evaluation and assessment office. So we have, you know, we do accountability all day long in terms of test scores and other kinds of measures. But if we start with your premise that everyone's in the same game and we're all doing what we need to be doing, then it really is about shared accountability. If we were in a lifeboat together, and we needed to get to wherever we needed to go, and it depended on everyone rowing together to get to where we needed to go, I would have as much at stake in the game as you would have to get us to our destination. And I think that's the kind of approach that we need to have. It's not about pointing fingers, but what role and expertise do you have, and how do you participate in this versus what I have, and how do we all bring what we need to bring to the table? Not me trying to do your job, because I can't do your job. I can't teach math. I'm fully aware of that. I know math, but I cannot teach math, and I don't need to be telling a math teacher what they need to do, but I do need to be supporting that math teacher in getting the resources he or she needs to do the best that they can do. Likewise, the math teacher doesn't necessarily run the HR department, and so the HR director needs to do what they need to do. And so I think we need to have this kind of shared dependency, which I think is a lot different than accountability, because most people hear accountability and they hear, who do I get to blame? Who do I get to rake over the coals? And that's very different to, who do I need to partner with? Who do I need to support and shore up? And so I think that's what's needed for us to change the paradigm.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I am, you know, this kind of, like, creepiness around testing is real interesting. Because, you know, like, I don't want to be on a road with anybody who hasn't passed a driver's test, right? I just think that that's, like, the first point. And so, you know, if you're testing just to test, and I think that's what has, like, been driving education, because, you know, because we got to prove that we're doing it, right, and we're being accountable. But there's another thing, and what the testing to just test, like our MCA2s, they come out when? They come out like spring, in the spring, right?
Or actually September, Labor Day. Around
Labor Day, right? And so the kid, they get this test, this high-stake test, and then in one grade, and then by the time the tests come out, they're in the next grade mm-hmm. with a different teacher who could care less about that last test they took. But it's the test that we look at to hold schools accountable. And so really that's like a doctor actually looking at the patient once they're dead and rigor mortis has set in, as opposed to the patient is sick, which a test looking at what are the standards and are you able to achieve against those standards that say you're on track for college readiness. Now that's a different conversation. Yeah. And that you actually use those to measure progress and then to give the equity that child, what he or she needs to move them along educationally. And so when you do it that way, the tests are an incredible thing. They're not going away. And part of accountability, what we know as parents and what educators all know, is that there are different benchmarks that tell you whether a kid, a scholar, is on their way to college or on their way to drop out. And the test are what show us predictably what's happening. So that's ready for kindergarten. Only way you really know if you're ready for kindergarten is if you're doing some kind of assessment of literacy and numeracy, right? So ready for kindergarten. And then the next benchmark is, are you at third grade reading by third grade? And you gotta have some kind of assessment to know that, because you're learning to read up to third grade, and then after third grade, you learn by reading. So if you haven't assessed to know that they are, they just kind of flounder through school and they drop out in 11th grade. And then there's 8th grade math. Are you actually at grade level? Because that predicts typically if you can cut it in school, in college, and not just take remedial courses. and then certainly graduating from high school, college ready. And so, again, if the assessments are used to really help determine where a child is and what he or she needs to grow, that's a different conversation. And so we can't run away from it. It is a factor of life.
I'm going to take a few more questions here. I wish I could read your mind and know that you have the most burning question in the room. I don't, but I'm going to take the hands that I am at least aware of that I've seen for some time. So a few more, and we'll try to get in here.
Hi. I'd like to hear thoughts on the solutions and programs to engage parents, because in a perfect world, we have lobbyists and community to get the policies right, and we have administrators to get the teachers engaged, and to Carrie's point, get the teachers, getting the students engaged. But there's no one over parents, and every day a kid is spending more time at home than they're at school, and then there's summer, where they're never at school. So how do you get the parents engaged?
So I think we have a couple of real positive efforts in our district. We have Parent Academy, which is designed to actually engage parents on their terms. And the first thing is to acknowledge, as I said before, that parents are a student's first teacher, and that if you don't have that solid partnership in whatever way it shows up, really we're not helping children be as successful as they can be. We need to change our paradigm as school systems that parents have to come to us. And I don't think I've met a parent ever, despite whatever needs or challenges he or she may have, that doesn't want the best for their child. And so you have to start with that assumption. Even if there are challenges, even if a child shows up a particular way and you have your perspective about what that parent is or isn't doing, the first assumption is that that parent wants the best for their child, and those are the terms that you approach that parent with. And so we have to be nimble enough to create opportunities for folks to be engaged. The first thing that I know is if you got a parent's child performing, if that child is doing something that they want to show, a parent is going to be there in some form or fashion. And so we have to create those multiple opportunities for them. But to something Sandra said before, parents also need the education about how they can support their children. Mm-hmm. Many of our parents have had negative experiences with school. They don't want anything to do with that school. And some parents are still in the same communities where they've gone to school. So it's not just school as school district. It's that particular school, that particular building that they want nothing to do with. And so we need to be able to change the paradigm and say, this isn't the experience that you've had. Really help the child also be a vehicle to engage the parent in their learning. And one of the things that I think was the most powerful for me was having our Parent Academy parents go through a graduation experience. And for some of them, that was the first time that they had actually graduated, because they didn't walk in their own, first of all, they didn't graduate from their school, or even if they got the diploma, they were so disaffected by the school experience that they never showed up for the walking ceremony. And so we had all of these parents who first, they were in full cap and gown, they had that experience of graduation, and it made a connection for them about what they needed to do to support their high school student in that learning. So I think it's about giving them the tools to really access what's going on, because as much as I know about education, I am fearful, my children are 4 and 2, but I'm fearful when they enter school and they come home with that homework assignment and they ask me to help them, because I know, as much as I know, I haven't been in the classroom in a really long time, and I might not be able to navigate those waters with everything that I know.
Yeah, Michelle. They say there's a direct correlation between the academic success of a child and his mother's academic attainment, or her mother's academic attainment, because of course, the correlation and where that would be. And so I got to tell you, within the zone, this is the strong point for us. This is where I think history is going to say these kind of movements of engaging parents is what turned the tide, and it is central to education reform, but we don't often make it part of that. And when we started the Northside Achievement Zone, the first thing we did is that people from the neighborhood who looked like the parents, that makes a difference, because the judgment isn't there, the bias isn't there, the belief is there, right? And we have high expectations for both our parents and our scholars. But they knocked on doors in North Minneapolis, and no matter what mom looked like, whatever stereotype, whether dad was there or his pants were hanging down his ankles or whatever, no matter what that was, our value proposition was, would you like your child to go to college? And there was not one parent who said, nah, you know, I was thinking Mookie would hang out on the corner, sell a little weed, pants down to his ankles, and get shot at. Right? Nobody said that. You know, they all said, yeah, I do. And then our next question in neighborhood parlance was, could you use somebody having your back? Now, there's no parent alive who doesn't need someone having their back. And the more we are resource deficient, the more support we need. And so we said, that's what we're here for. We're going to partner with you. And so we have something, and I think that this is what the country needs, and it's happening in a lot of communities. We have NAS connectors, and they are from the community. We hire them. We hire the attitude. We teach the skill. And they partner with the parents, and the parents sign a college-bound commitment, and they get into our pipeline. And they get support and partnership all along the way. Today we have 609 parents who are part of the Northside Achievement Zone, and they are all on this continuum of healthiness and dysfunction, of involvement and lack of, just like we all are here. Some of us are crazy. But anyway, they're showing up. They are showing up, and they're working their own achievement plan. We're not doing it for them. They're doing it. So when we put the right supports in place, but you have to be willing to put the money behind it to make that kind of thing happen.
I think I agree with all of that. And to follow up with what Michelle said about going to the parents sometimes, I know we do home visits. I've sat in the homes of some of my students and to know where they come from, talk to their parents there. If we're not willing to go to them as a school, like it's got to go two ways. Mm-hmm. The paradigm that parents just show up to school and like that's the way it is and that's the way it's always been has to change, especially when you're talking about kids in poverty who are highly mobile or transient. You have to find a way to bridge that gap and make it accessible. So we do a lot of that at Venture Academy. We had conferences last night and we bused parents in. We got a school bus and brought them to us so that they could get there and stay till like 8 p.m. to make sure that they could have those conferences with translators we needed. Like we have to be willing to go that extra mile or extra 100 miles to make sure kids get what they need and to make sure that the parents feel welcome and part of the community.
This is where I have to now apologize to everyone else and say that we got to wrap it up. I can take one more question here, and then you guys can hate me for not getting to your question. I'm so sorry, but hashtag policy pint is where the conversation can continue. I encourage our guests to, I know you guys, actually, at least two of you guys have specific places to go right after you get out the door, but check back with the Twitter feed when you can. I know a lot of people would still love to hear from you if it's possible. But I'll take one more question here, and then I'll be up with you.
So I hope this is a good question, because it's the last question.
Hell yeah, it better be a good question.
There are only good questions.
So one of the biggest trends in the United States right now in education is sort of the corporatization or the corporate school reform movement. So big foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Koch Foundation have donated a lot of money to education. So I'm just sort of interested in what your views on that sort of corporate influence in the schools are, and do you see it as being beneficial for students in a way of providing additional resources? There are people who say it's detrimental with teacher evaluations and all these other kind of policies that they're pushing. So what are your views on the role of the corporate sector in schools today?
That's a very nice way to ask that question, it seems to me. There's a lot of animosity, quite frankly, about that. So, yes.
Okay, let's take that one. Yeah, so right. So that is at the center of the struggle right now. Like anything that gets labeled education reform, it's like, oh, there's this evil corporation behind that movement trying to destroy public education. And it's like no sector of our, when we start looking at we talk about education as a moral imperative. It's also an economic imperative, right? And so if you want to talk about who has a bigger stake in this, businesses and industry. they're late to the game, in my opinion, like completely late, because they've been funding stuff that doesn't work. And it's like, finally, let's start funding innovation. Let's start funding some things that change and stop funding, stop doing the insanity of funding the same thing year after year and getting the same terrible, terrible outcomes. And so that's the thing. And so, you know, I tell you, we, you know, again, with the economic imperative, we talked about it a little bit, but straight up, if we don't get this right as a business community, the Twin Cities and this region is going down. I mean, we cannot survive. This achievement gap impacts us all. In Hennepin County, 48% of our citizens, 0 to 5, are children of color. In Hennepin County, 0 to 5, 48%, according to the last census. In St. Paul and Ramsey County, over 50% of the children 0 to 5 are children of color. But we are dead last in the country of graduating children of color in 4 years from high school, right? And so just do the math and play it out into the future. The Fortune 500 corporations that are here, they're not here because of our beachfront property. They're not. They're here. The General Mills, the Pillsbury, God rest their soul, you know, all of those big corporations, they were here because we have such a crazy educated workforce, and we still do. But when you're looking at your five-year-olds who are the majority children of color and how we are failing them, we can't sustain it. That's why businesses are at the table now. That's why they're playing in the game. And again, I say that they're late.
Yeah.
I mean, well said.
All right. Yeah, Michelle.
The only thing that I would say about that is because I think districts actually get a lot of that rage. It's either districts or large charter management organizations that get a lot of the rage around corporate influence. And so I agree with the concept that not all money is good money, but I would certainly follow up with what Sandra said about who has the most at stake. And what we've tried to do, regardless of the source of the money, is to make sure that we're not chasing the money, right, but that we actually have the resources to do the things that we think are important. Right. And in my experience, dealing with philanthropic donations or grants or whatever, we've turned it around where the person coming with the resources shouldn't necessarily be telling those who are most informed about the strategies and practices what to do. They should be having a conversation about the outcomes, the shared outcomes that we want to see, but they should leave the experts to design and to do the implementation. And when that combination is there, when that success is there, when it's a partnership, then I think wherever you can find the resources that are helpful to advance those causes, then I think that is something that we should be doing, and we should be bringing all the resources to bear. And I don't really necessarily see the big corporate reform animal, because I do think they have a stake in the game, and it's really up to those who are engaging with those entities to make sure that it's a partnership that has children at the heart of it, mm-hmm. and that is in the best interest for what we want to get done.
Well said.
Yep. I'll close with this. We had this came in on Twitter. What good things are happening in Minnesota to close the gap that... I want to read it verbatim. I'll translate. What good things that are happening in Minnesota to close the gap are the things that all of us here in the room, when we leave tonight, we can support?
I think one of the... So I came here from Oakland, California, about a year and a half ago. And one of the... I was talking to Michelle a little bit about this earlier. One of the things that was shocking to me is one of the first places I went was to Pillsbury House, United Communities, up in the north side, and asked the executive director, what do I need to know coming into Minneapolis about the landscape? And the thing that shocked me was the conversation was only just beginning. Mm-hmm. In the last year, I've seen the conversation about the achievement gap, about how we're failing our kids here, happening more and more. And I think the thing that we can all do is continue to have that conversation openly, not sidestep it, but like walk straight through it fearlessly, because that's what it's going to take. Real, honest, true, difficult conversation about this to best meet the needs of these kids.
Yeah, well, you know, one good thing is, I mean, all of you knew that this was about education tonight, right? And you actually came. I mean, this is like a trip to me that this place is full, and that means people are concerned about it. Their hearts are there. Now, of course, you know, being concerned and your heart being there is a different thing than actually taking action. I'm going to just close with, let me see if I can get this right. There were 4 frogs on a log, and 3 of the frogs decided to jump off. How many frogs were left on the log? 4. And 4, because making a decision is different than taking action. And so you may have made a decision that you can no longer tolerate the egregiousness of this achievement gap, but now it's time to take action. And that is looking at the policies that that hold schools accountable for what they do best, and that's teach and having outcomes, that supporting policies that let resources flow to supporting families who need the most support to wrap around them so that they can show up as the baby's first teacher and be engaged in the school system, and keep your eye and don't let the urgency. That's my biggest prayer for you guys, that you know that the house is on fire. Mm-hmm. You never just think that the roof is just a little leaky, but the house is on fire.
So I would echo a lot of what's been said. I think one of the great things about what's happening is that we have a lot of dedicated people engaged in the conversation. And I am excited about that, and equally frustrated by the fact that we are engaged in a conversation and not collectively engaged in action. And so I welcome these discussions, and I love being a part of them. And quite frankly, I wish that we didn't have to be talking about it still.
Yeah. And this is really awesome. What I mean, is that when everybody leaves here tonight, exactly how, if they agree with what you've said, and what if they believe in what you're talking about here tonight, you know, what do we do when we go out tomorrow morning? I mean, before the next election comes around, what do we do tomorrow?
Someone asked a similar question on a panel that I was in, and sometimes this issue is so huge and so enormous that most people feel like they can't do anything.
Right.
And so all of us are experts in something in our professional lives and our personal lives, and we should do all of that and engage in whatever technical ways that we can. But if we want to narrow this down to the most simplest thing that you could do for a child, is to be that caring adult in a child's life so that no child has the opportunity to escape. And our college and career director says we need to be a powerful force for our school-age children, and we need to hold them accountable that we have the expectations for them. So the next time you see a young child, and better yet, the next time you see an African-American male, ask that person where they're going to college. Ask them what you could do to support them. Be that constant reminder that you believe in that child and that you can support that child. It could be your very own child, but I hope that you can broaden your net beyond your child. But be a powerful force for a child. If you can do nothing else, you might not want to go testify at the state capitol. You might not want to come to a board meeting, but you can have high expectations for one person, one child, so that that child can reach their potential and be that support for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And we need a lot of mentors in the Northside Achievement Zone, by the way. We're working with Big Brothers, Big Sisters, Boulder Options, and Kinship. So any of those organizations, but on the Northside in the Zone. I think, so one of the major things in terms of moving forward, a step that people can take, I don't know how comfortable many of you are in here around really what's happening in the education landscape. You know, I've been working in education for about a decade now, and I still feel really ignorant most times. You know, especially if I go, you know, like, what is that policy? What does that mean? You know what? And I mean, the first school board meeting, I thought I had gone to Mars. But the thing is, unless you, like, make a commitment to really find out what's happening educationally, it's not enough just to hear achievement gap and be cool with that. But, like, show up at school board meetings. You know, talk to friends who are working in education. Read, find out what the real issues are, and then show up and take action. Show up and show out.
So yes, go mentor in schools in Venture Academies, 27th and University down the street. You're welcome anytime if you want to come read with some kids or do some math. But I think beyond that, just be take. take that action around the fact that there is a totally invisible group of young people in this city that are becoming more visible, but don't be part of the problem. Don't be part of the problem. Like, be aware that there's a lot of systemic violence that exists in the Twin Cities that is specifically related to the fact that there are pockets of kids here that are just going through the system totally unacknowledged. So, as both of you said, show up and show out and be there for them. Find a way to do it, whatever works for you.
Michelle Walker and Sondra Samuels and Carrie Muse, a big round of applause for our guests here tonight. Thank you so much, guys.
You're